In the West Bank today, an iconic Palestinian-American journalist is shot and killed.
She gave voice to struggles of Palestinians over a career spanning nearly three decades.
The death of Shireen Abu Akleh raises bigger questions than just how did this happen. Also today, Vladimir Putin is keeping his cards close to his chest, leaving Washington unsure of how far he's willing to escalate the war.
That obviously is the critical problem right now, is that in many ways we're operating in the dark as to what Putin ultimately is going to decide to do.
And Germany is in a rush to move past Russian natural gas. One solution, bring in liquefied natural gas from the U.S. A quick fix that could also set back Germany's long-term climate goals.
We see it as economic and ecological madness.
All that and more today here on The World. Thank you for joining us. We begin with news from the West Bank, where a veteran Palestinian-American journalist with Al Jazeera was shot and killed today. Shireen Abu Akleh was covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp. Palestinian sources, as well as Al Jazeera, blame Israeli forces. The Israeli army initially said stray fire from a Palestinian militant may have killed Abu Akleh, then said it was unclear who fired the deadly bullet. To remember Shireen Abu Akleh, we reached out to Dalia Hatuka. She's also a Palestinian-American journalist and a longtime friend of Shireen's.
Shireen was on assignment in Jenin in the West Bank. She was covering an Israeli raid on a refugee camp where she was killed. I just watched an extended video of the incident. Shireen was wearing a vest that said press on it, and she was wearing a helmet. And the shot came through the back of her neck and out of her face. She didn't stand a chance. She didn't have time to take cover. Palestinian authorities are basically blaming Israeli soldiers for the killing. They believe that it was an intentional kill. They also do not believe that a probe by the Israelis, which the Israelis said they would do, would yield anything, based on past shootings of journalists have happened before, and most probes have not yielded any result. So they do not have faith that that will bring in any justice to her family.
So you said, Dalia, that journalists have been shot at before. But when was the last time something like this happened, where the reporter is clearly designated as press and becomes a victim?
Well, this has happened multiple times. I would say some of the times I recall things like that have happened are the killings of Ahmed Abu Hussein and Yasser Murtaza. They were two journalists who were fatally shot by Israeli snipers while covering the Great March of Return protests in Gaza in 2018. There was also the targeting and bombing of buildings housing media in the Gaza Strip, including the Israeli air raid that destroyed the 11-story Al Jala building, which housed Al Jazeera and associated press offices in May 2021. So this is not an isolated incident. It's happened before. And unfortunately, probes into killings or targetings like that have yielded very little.
Yeah, I mean, just to get an idea of what happens after incidents like a couple of the ones you mentioned, what do the investigations reveal and who's involved in those investigations?
Basically, the investigations are carried out by the Israeli authorities. Obviously, the Israeli soldiers are involved, and it's hard to kind of believe that these probes will yield anything, especially when the same power, so to speak, that is involved in the killing is also carrying out the investigation.
She was a highly credible reporter with Al Jazeera. What do you remember most about how she approached her work?
Well, for people who don't know her, Shireen was a Palestinian Christian from Jerusalem. She was a brave and kind reporter. She had an infectious laugh. She gave voice to struggles of Palestinians over a career spanning nearly three decades. She started working for Al Jazeera almost since its inception in 1996 or 1997. And then in the Second Intifada, her name became a mainstay in every Palestinian home, to the extent that during the height of the Second Intifada, I recall Israeli soldiers going around Ramallah and mimicking her, shouting from a bullhorn her famous closing lines, Shireen Abu Akleh Al Jazeera Ramallah. A lot of women journalists and aspiring journalists have told me they wanted to be her. They would use a hairbrush and pretend it were a microphone and stand in front of a mirror and pretend to be Shireen. And so I would say that it's a huge loss, not just for journalists, but particularly for women journalists and Palestinian women journalists who aspire to be, to work in a dangerous environment, basically.
What was it about that second intifada that turned Shireen into that icon you just described?
She went to every home. You could find her in every refugee camp, every village, every town. Everybody knew her. She was very soft-spoken. She was so down to earth, shy at times even. She covered so many tragedies, but her smile was constantly there. Her laugh was infectious. And everybody she encountered, like personally, felt this kind of connection to her. And I think covering Israeli atrocities in Palestine never broke her. It never stopped her from appreciating and enjoying life.
All journalists in the Mideast do take a certain level of risk, but Palestinian journalists frequently accuse Israel of violating media rights and freedom of expression. Is that your experience?
Every time there's been a situation where we do try to cover something, you get this violent reaction from Israeli police or Israeli forces. And I would say most of it is uncalled for. A lot of it has to do with, like, every time you set a tripod or you put out your microphone, you immediately get this angry reaction. I believe that Israeli authorities don't want people to know what's going on here.
Ultimately, Dalia, how do you think any journalist can be protected as they do their work to cover the occupation of the West Bank and the region as a whole? I mean, we know there's no guarantees, right?
No, there are no guarantees. You just go there and you take a risk, and it's a gamble. You know, you try your best to stay out of harm's way. Like I said, you know, there was no way for Shireen or any of the journalists who have been killed to have known about any of it. She knew Janine like the back of her hand, and she wouldn't put herself in harm's way like that. But at the end of the day, like, you just don't know.
Dalia Hatouka is a Palestinian-American journalist covering the West Bank. She was also a longtime friend of Shireen Abu Akleh, the Palestinian-American journalist with Al Jazeera, who was shot and killed in the West Bank today, age 51. Dalia, thank you for your time. And again, we're very sorry for your loss, all our loss.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Europe is racing to get off of Russian natural gas. To replace that, countries are starting to build infrastructure to receive shipments of liquefied natural gas, LNG, that can be transported on ships from places like the U.S. and Qatar. Germany is leading the way on this. It's proposing 6 new LNG terminals. A fix for a pressing problem, a fix that could put the country's also pressing climate goals out of reach. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler has more from Germany's northern coast.
Germany's economy and climate minister Robert Habeck was in the North Sea port town of Wilhelmshaven last week with microphones and TV cameras in tow. He was there to sign lease agreements for 4 new floating liquefied natural gas storage facilities. This is how we become independent from Russian energy, he said in a video. The German government is also backing 2 permanent liquefied natural gas import facilities. And despite the fanfare, all of this is controversial.
We need to get rid of fossil fuels, and we should not build new fossil infrastructure.
Richard Knopf runs an environmental group in one of the states slated to get a floating LNG terminal and a permanent one. We met near the mouth of the Elbe River on Germany's northern coast. He and I stand on a tall earthen dike where sheep are grazing.
This is where the jetty for the LNG tankers will be built. And if we turn around,
that's where shipped LNG will be regasified and distributed. Germany aims to become carbon neutral by 2045, and Knopf doesn't see how that's going to happen with all this new infrastructure.
We see it as moral and economic and ecological madness.
Madness because climate scientists say building and using new fossil fuel infrastructure will make meeting climate targets impossible. The German government says that turning to liquefied natural gas is a short-term solution to meeting the country's energy needs, and that the new gas terminals will be built to eventually handle hydrogen fuel produced by renewable energy. But already, Reuters reports that one major LNG seller, Qatar, is balking at Germany's desire for shorter-term contracts.
For us, this seems to be kind of a fossil trap.
Konstantin Serger is with the NGO Environmental Action Germany.
So we are building a new fossil infrastructure in Germany, which is connected to fossil infrastructure overseas, which is connected to new extraction projects, and this will all end up to additional greenhouse gas emissions all around the world.
The White House has pledged to more than double U.S. LNG exports to Europe by 2030, and planned gas liquefaction projects have been moving forward faster than before the war, says analyst Jack Winters.
There has been a lot of activity that has picked up.
Winters is with S&P Global Commodity Insights. He says in the next 5 years, capacity for liquefying natural gas in the U.S. will jump 60%, which will have to mean more production.
As a whole, you would need a production increase from the U.S. producers to be able to feed this LNG export capacity expected to come online.
This all brings Konstantin Serger to say something surprising for an environmental activist, that it might be better for Germany to keep burning coal a little bit longer than to spur this kind of natural gas development.
We will have coal, which is from an environmental point of view, of course, terrible, but it might buy us some time to get the renewables in place. And this might be a better option than building new LNG terminals.
Germany already missed its greenhouse gas reduction targets last year, and the economy and climate minister Robert Habeck says it's likely to miss them this year and next. But he insists that the new gas infrastructure doesn't put the country's longer-term targets at risk. Downtown Brunsbüttel sits on the Elbe River, a few miles away from the site of the planned LNG terminal. The mayor there, Martin Schmetia, reacts with a deep sigh when I ask him about the challenges of getting off of Russian energy.
It's unbeschreiblich. Unbeschreiblich schwierig.
It's indescribably difficult, he says.
Stop den Krieg. Stop the war.
The mayor is against the war, but he'll be glad if the LNG terminal gets built. He wants the jobs and revenue it'll bring to his town.
Natürlich steht es im Gegensatz zueinander auf den ersten Blick. Meine Tochter ist 20 Jahre alt und meine Tochter sagt, man darf...
But he says, of course, there are conflicting interests here. His own daughter says no one should be investing in fossil fuel infrastructure. He partly agrees, but thinks Germany needs this LNG terminal to keep the economy growing. These conflicting viewpoints will likely play out across Europe, where nearly a dozen new liquefied gas import facilities have been proposed since the war in Ukraine started. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Brunsbüttel, Germany.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Hopes for a quick end to the war in Ukraine are rapidly fading. Russia's President Vladimir Putin seems to be digging in his heels even further.
We assess President Putin is preparing for a prolonged conflict in Ukraine, during which he still intends to achieve goals beyond the Donbas.
That's U.S. Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines testifying on Capitol Hill yesterday about Putin's goals beyond the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. We reached out to former CIA Director and Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, who says the path of the war is unpredictable. I asked Panetta how the intelligence community understands Putin's intentions.
That is the challenge for intelligence, is to try to get into the mind of Putin, which is not easy to do. If he in fact acknowledges that we are in a stalemate, is this something that is going to continue to challenge him? He's going to continue to try to see if he can find a way to some kind of victory, or at least something he can call a victory, or whether or not he's going to try to escalate to show how desperate he is. We don't know the answer to that question. And that obviously is the critical problem right now, is that in many ways we're operating in the dark as to what Putin ultimately is going to decide to do.
I want to probe how U.S. officials go about assessing the threat of nuclear war in this case. Let's hear DNI Haines again testifying before Congress yesterday.
We otherwise continue to believe that President Putin would probably only authorize the use of nuclear weapons if he perceived an existential threat to the Russian state or regime, but we will remain vigilant in monitoring every aspect of Russia's strategic nuclear forces.
So who's to say what an existential threat is in Putin's mind? Isn't there a range of things that U.S. officials have already said that are essentially telegraphing regime change? I mean, Biden said, for God's sake, this man cannot remain in power.
The question is whether or not Putin has reached a point of desperation that will force him to escalate as his only option. The other side of that question is whether or not Putin understands the consequences of doing something like that. And, you know, I think there's some rationale here based on what he said on May 9th that indicates to me, at least, that he has not decided that he's going to say to hell with everything and push the button with regards to nuclear war or dramatically escalating that battle. I think my sense is that he's trying to exercise some care here as to just how far he's going to be willing to take this.
So how do you think, Leon Panetta, Ukraine's allies in the West should be thinking about what to do, how best to support Ukraine if this conflict drags on and becomes a war of attrition?
The key here is to make clear that there is no crack in the unity of the United States and our allies, because I'm sure that Putin in some ways is hoping that at some point in a prolonged stalemate that unity will crack.
Leon Panetta, let me tack away from the testimony on Capitol Hill yesterday. Recent headlines credit U.S. intelligence with playing a key role in targeting Russian generals and sinking a Russian warship. If you were still heading the CIA, how would you react to those sorts of leaks?
Well, I wouldn't like the fact that that kind of information, you know, is made public or is basically defined in a way that may not necessarily be true. The idea that somehow we're targeting generals or we're targeting ships, so that may not necessarily be true. We provide intelligence. It is legal. It's limited. It's accurate. It's timely. It's actionable intelligence. Usually involves movement of troops, tanks, ships. But it is up to the Ukrainians to decide what the targets are going to be, and it's up to the Ukrainians to pull the trigger.
Leon Panetta is a former director of Central Intelligence and former Secretary of Defense. Secretary Panetta, thank you very much for speaking with us again.
Good to be with you.
Generally speaking, immigration law is not the specialty you go into if you're an attorney who wants to earn a lot of money. But it is a field where there's a huge need for lawyers. At the University of Colorado Law School, a new generation of law students is now focusing on asylum and immigration. Stephanie Daniel reports that many of the students themselves come from immigrant families.
Standing next to a projector screen, University of Colorado Law School professor Violetta Chapin shows several images of different groups of immigrants at the U.S. southern border to her students.
There are some really sort of stark visual differences between the treatment of Ukrainian refugees and treatment that we saw of refugees mostly from Latin America and from Haiti over the last few years, but also just over the last few months.
This class is part of the law school's Immigration Defense Clinic. It's one of nine clinics at the law school in Boulder that allows students to get hands-on experience representing clients. Chapin, who was born in Costa Rica, is the director of this clinic. She explained its importance during an interview.
Immigrants, if they want a lawyer, and many of them do and need a lawyer, you know, they have to pay shocking amounts of money for an immigration lawyer, and many of them just simply can't afford it.
One of Chapin's students is Larissa Aleri. The second-year student has been passionate about immigration rights since her teens.
And my high school was like 90% Latino, and a lot of my peers were undocumented, and they really didn't learn that they were undocumented until we were like, you know, old enough to get our first job. And you realize, oh, shoot, I don't have a social security number.
Immigration law is complex. But just like her classmates, Aleri has learned a lot during the year-long course. They've helped clients renew their Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival, or DACA status. The students also work under Chapin's supervision and bar license, which allows them to assist on criminal cases.
This semester, I had a criminal immigration case, and my client was a lawful permanent resident charged with a petty crime.
The clinic has also represented over 20 longtime university employees from El Salvador. They have temporary protected status, or TPS, which allows them to work. The students are helping them become permanent residents. Maria Teresa Navas Mejia has worked at the university for 23 years. She is a housekeeper in the dorms and loves her job. With the help of students, she got her green card last August.
Me siento bien contenta.
I feel so happy. When they told me they were going to give me my residency, I just cried. Because for me, it was a big achievement.
Translating is recent Colorado Law School graduate Karina De La Torre. She was one of Professor Chapin's students and now has an 18-month-long fellowship with the university's law clinics. She plans on taking the bar in July and pursuing immigration work with a nonprofit.
My parents are immigrants. I have a lot of undocumented family members, and I just saw how unfair and unjust our immigration system is.
One of her main jobs is working with TPS holders like Navas Mejia, who mainly work in dining and custodial services at the university.
These employees are part of our community. They own houses. They go to the same schools that professors have their children at.
The school is supportive of the clinic, says Patrick O'Rourke, the executive vice chancellor for the University of Colorado's Boulder campus.
Part of what we need to be able to do is understand the challenges that undocumented workers face, particularly those who are part of our community, and be able to recognize their rights and have our students invested in being able to make the world a more just place.
Second-year student Marina Fleming says the clinic work has underscored the importance of immigration law.
It allows you to see all of the doors that can be available to you as a practitioner and how many doors you can potentially open up for other people who are navigating any number of immigration issues in their lives.
The first-generation college student says the clinic is her favorite part of law school. It makes the learning feel real.
Being able to go to court and to speak to a judge and to feel what it feels like to stand up to assert your voice, not for yourself, but on behalf of another person, is powerful.
For The World, I'm Stephanie Daniel in Denver.
Time again for the Eurovision Song Contest. It's all about the music and wild performances, but this year the judges have a different view of the Ukrainian artists.
It's a challenging time for Eurovision itself, because should Ukraine win, I think it will be the first time we've actually had a country winning, possibly because of the politics.
And in Cuba, tourism takes a big hit. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. If the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, it will undo a legal precedent for abortions that's been in place for nearly 50 years. Here at The World, we've been checking in on laws and attitudes toward abortion in different parts of the globe. In India, abortion has been legal within certain constraints for more than half a century. From Mumbai, The World's Chavi Sachdev has our story.
While the United States is consumed in the debate over abortion access, India's media has been full of self-congratulatory remarks about its progressive abortion laws. In 1971, when a national law made it legal for people to end a pregnancy, it was considerably ahead of the times. It allowed for married women to get an abortion up to 20 weeks into a pregnancy under medical supervision if the pregnancy were harmful to her life or physical or mental health, and if the child would be born with severe disabilities. Last year, this was amended to strike out the word married and to extend the gestation period to 24 weeks for minors and survivors of rape or incest. But experts in the fields of human rights as well as medicine have said that while the letter of the law is fairly broad, the spirit of the law, as well as its implementation, have a lot of room for improvement.
It is still not a rights-based approach.
Dr. Suchitra Dalvi heads the Asia Safe Abortion Partnership and is a practicing gynecologist in Mumbai. She says the law was a response to India's high maternal mortality rate in the 60s. In Indian society, having a child out of wedlock is considered shameful for the whole family. So women were dying from unsafe abortions, honor killings, and by suicide. Dalvi says legalizing surgical abortions and then the medical abortion pill provided a safe alternative.
So the law has really provided every possible facility for privacy, confidentiality, your autonomy within the extent of, you know, whatever is approved. That's not the practical reality. No?
The latest data from the WHO says every day, 8 women in India still die from botched abortions. A big factor is the stigma. While abortion is not a religious issue, Dalvi says it's all about preserving the patriarchy.
Because, of course, you know, in our society, motherhood is so glorified. It's kind of, you know, infertility is stigmatized, abortion is stigmatized.
Abortions are sought through the Whisper Network and never discussed publicly, which also results in a lot of misinformation. For this story, I spoke to a number of women who had abortions or supported someone in getting one, but no one would speak on the record. A lot of women don't even know that for termination up to 12 weeks, the supervision of just a single registered medical practitioner is required, and between 12 and 20 weeks, two doctors. Beyond that gestation period, a board has to weigh in. Critics say this robs women of their agency and gives doctors too much say. The data suggests that somewhere between 70 and 85% of abortions are done with the medical abortion pill, which is available with a prescription for about $7. But the majority of these are sold in the black market and used at home, even though self-administrating an abortion pill is a crime.
They're obviously doing it safely because the maternal mortality rate, if anything, has gone down in the last 5 years.
Recently, it's been harder to buy. I went to my local pharmacy to see if I could get an abortion pill called the Medical Termination of Pregnancy Kit, or colloquially, the pill to drop your baby.
Aap medical termination kit bechte hain?
Nahi.
Bachcha girane ke liye medicine?
Nahi nahi.
Rakhte nahi.
Kahan pe milega? Mangale dena padega.
They first didn't understand what I was asking for, and then they said they don't stock it. Surveys show that this is a subtle form of moral policing sexually active women. Then I stopped by a college campus to ask some of the students about abortion rights.
No, we don't have any idea about it.
Do you think it's legal? Illegal?
I think
it's illegal. If the girl is above 18, then it's legal that if she do abortion or not, that her choice.
They were all hesitant about where someone would go for more information. Another big problem, according to critics of the law. Data shows that even some rural community health workers and doctors believe abortion is illegal or that a husband's signature is necessary. The only time practitioners and the law seem to agree is when the pregnant person is disabled or carrying a fetus with disabilities or has been assaulted. The amendments, Dr. Dalvi says, could have been more inclusive.
The one which really works is removing the word married, because it at least takes away the control that some not very pro-choice doctors have used in the past to not offer abortions to women. But considering that we've already passed the transgender bill, they could have said person also. It still says woman.
There's no organized opposition to expanding abortion access, but there are concerns that easier access will result in illegal sex determination and women choosing to birth only boys and abort girls.
Rather than creating a society where the girl child is as wanted as the boy child, which has all your economic, political implications, you want to make sure the girl child is born only to service the men.
Dalvi and other abortion rights advocates want women to be seen as persons with selfhood, identity and volition. She says safe abortion rights are at the very core of feminism and human rights, and they'll continue to advocate for change. For The World, I'm Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai.
In Havana, the rescue effort at a collapsed luxury hotel continues. An explosion at the Hotel Saratoga last Friday killed at least 43 people and wounded dozens more. Most of the dead were hotel workers, housekeepers, cooks, and executives, getting one of Cuba's most storied hotels ready for reopening after a two-year pandemic hiatus. A tragedy just as Cuba is trying hard to get its tourism sector back on track. The government depends on the foreign currency it brings in. Elias Amor Bravo is a Cuban-born economist who lives in Spain. How big was the tourist industry in Cuba, Elias, prior to the pandemic, and where are things at today?
Cuba had an objective before the pandemics of 5 million visitors per year. This objective was never accomplished. The country remained in 2019 at about 4.2 million tourists. And these figures have completely go down since then. And now we are running about 2 million tourists for 2022. 2 million tourists was the figure around 1998. About 30 years ago.
So pre-pandemic, where were most of the tourists to Cuba coming from, and how did the pandemic change that?
Most of the tourists in Cuba came from Canada, the most important market. The second is coming from the United States. The Cuban nationals living in the United States, they call it La Comunidad Cubana en el Exterior, and after that, European countries. This distribution is very similar to the Dominican Republic distribution of tourism. But in Dominican Republic, the number of Americans who travel and to make tourism is higher than in Cuba, where the only Americans are basically Cuban Americans.
I also read an incredible statistic that 40% of tourists to Cuba come from Russia. Is that still the case?
No, not at all. Russia increased during the last year because there was a fall in Canadians and Americans, Cuban Americans and the other countries because of the pandemics and the interruption of mobility. But Russia came in a very important proportion, but never 40%. And it has never been a very important market for the tourism in Cuba. In fact, more Russians are traveling to Dominican Republic and Cancun than Cuba. And this is something that Cuban authorities have also to analyze and explain the reasons why.
I want to further unpack that tourism economy. If we look at the Hotel Saratoga in Old Havana, site of that tragedy last week, it's a famous hotel, elegant 19th century building. Celebrities have stayed there like Mick Jagger and Beyonce. But it's operated by Gaviota, which is owned by the Cuban military. Explain that for us.
This means that the tourism model in Cuba is not privately owned, like, for example, in Dominican Republic or in Spain. In Spain, we have also state hotels, for example, but it's only a small part of the tourism sector. In Cuba, all the tourism sector belongs to the state, and they are run by political decisions, not economic decisions, like, for example, in Dominican Republic, Cancun. This is a very important difference from Cuba to the other tourist countries, because an excessive weight of the government in the economic decisions of the sector conducts different solutions for the sector. For example, in Cuba, the number of rooms built by the government since 2013 has grown more rapidly than the number of visitors from 2013 and 2019 before the pandemic. In Cuba, you cannot buy properties. If you are a tourist and you are a visitor to the country, you can enjoy in the resorts located in the coast, but you cannot buy a property like in Dominican Republic, for example. This is something that limits the potential of the sector, and it's one of the restrictions for the development in the future of this sector for the Cuban economy.
So President Biden still has not lifted the Trump-era reversal on Obama's policy of opening up to Cuba. Remind us what restrictions are still in place, like non-family visits to Cuba, what impact they're having now as Cuba tries to revive tourism.
I know that there are restrictions, but all other countries in the world, 192 countries, have no restrictions to travel to Cuba. And whatever citizen of whatever country in the world can go to Cuba to enjoy their holidays and to make travel of tourism. The restrictions to Americans are applied only to Americans in the sense that they are not Cuban Americans who can travel to Cuba whatever they want. I think that these restrictions are embodied in the situation between both countries, and that situation is easily to be solved if the Cuban government should decide to solve it.
Elias, how critical is it for Cuba to grow its tourism sector? Does it really depend on it?
Well, I think that this is one of the most important sectors of the economy, and the government of Cuba knows it. And for this reason, they are very concerned with the tourism sector and the increase of their activities in order to obtain the scales of production. Meanwhile, the government does not recognize the importance of private activity in the sector. The situation of the tourism in Cuba will not function in terms of stability and sustainability.
Elias Amor Bravo is a Cuban economist. He's based in Spain. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
When Carnival hit Rio de Janeiro last month, the parades passed through what had been a drive-through COVID vaccination center at the height of the pandemic. Since its peaks of COVID cases back in January, Brazil seems to have weathered its battle with the pandemic for now. It's also facing another epidemic, dengue, a potentially deadly virus spread by mosquitoes. More than 650,000 people in Brazil have gotten sick since the beginning of the year, far surpassing all of last year's dengue cases. Michael Fox has a story.
Georgia Heck really loves cats. You can tell that from this video of her taking care of a fluffy gray tabby cat named Delicia. She's a cat sitter in Porto Alegre, a city in southern Brazil. That's what she was doing in mid-March when she suddenly got the chills. By the time she got home, she could barely lift herself up the stairs to her second-story apartment.
Calafrios, frio, né? Daí fui ver que era febre, febre alta.
I had the chills, she says, high fever, headaches. I started to have neck pain. But the main thing is that I was really tired. I couldn't even sit up. I had to lay down. She thought she had COVID, but the tests came back negative. It wasn't until a week later, after her gums started to bleed, that a neighbor suggested she might have dengue. She took a test. It came back positive.
Ah, mas dengue? Nunca tinha me passado pela cabeça.
I never imagined I could have dengue, she says. I always thought dengue was only found in neighborhoods without proper sanitation, more trash, and more overgrown. Porto Alegre is one of those places where dengue is usually almost unheard of. Not anymore.
O movimento de pacientes com dengue, ele é histórico.
The number of patients arriving with dengue is historic, says Alexandre Zavascki. He's the head of infectology at Moinhos do Vento, the largest private hospital in the city. We've seen hundreds of cases of dengue just in this one hospital, he says. That is the situation across much of the country. It's really concerning, says Alexandre Barbosa, vice president of the Brazilian Society of Infectious Diseases. We've already seen a tragic number of cases of dengue this year. And it's not just dengue, he says. Zika and chikungunya, which are also transmitted by the Aedes aegypti mosquito, are also on the rise. Brazil hasn't seen this level of dengue, Zika, and chikungunya since before the pandemic. Scientists are hypothesizing that infection of these diseases dropped over the last 2 years because less people were circulating due to COVID-19. Infectious disease specialists say a perfect storm has now allowed the Aedes aegypti mosquito to proliferate and the viruses to get out of hand. Heavy rains associated with La Niña weather pattern hit major parts of Brazil this year while the country swam through the Omicron COVID-19 wave. Those rains left stagnant water, breeding ground for Aedes aegypti.
A dengue é coisa séria. O estado já conta com mais de 10 mil casos confirmados.
Usually, during the Brazilian spring and early summer months near the end of the year, Brazilian cities are already running education campaigns about dengue and mosquito prevention like this one. They send out public health teams door to door to educate residents how to keep their yards clear of stagnant water and to spray areas with insecticides that are already out of control. All of that stopped when COVID hit. It's been a slow start to get it rolling again, but cities are now taking action. In this video shared online, municipal police and public health workers in the southern Brazilian city of Florianópolis clear out an overgrown abandoned lot with several busted up cars. Health workers are again spraying and visiting residents. Nowhere is this more urgent than in the central Brazilian state of Goiás, which is ground zero for this year's dengue epidemic. The number of cases in the state are 5 times the national average. In late April, health officials in the capital, Goiânia, found Aedes aegypti mosquitoes at 30% of homes they visited.
É possível evitar a dengue com medidas simples.
The city has published a series of short videos online called Myths and Truths about Dengue as a way of combating misinformation. It's also launched catchy jingles like this to encourage people to clean up their environment. The video shows people cleaning up their yards as the words sing, "Turn over your cans, close your garbage, pick up your trash. Mosquitoes won't breed in my house."
Prefeitura de Goiânia.
They're trying to make up for the lost time, but doctors say they're still not enough. The country needs a coordinated effort, which is not happening. If there's one bright spot on the horizon, the weather in the coming months will likely be favorable. The center and north of the country is moving into its dry season. The south is heading toward winter and cooler temperatures that mosquitoes don't like. Many hope it can help Brazil get the epidemic under control. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
Head over to theworld.org to catch up with stories you might have missed, from the extreme heat wave in India to a new multilingual archive for Radio Haiti at Duke University. Those stories and more are on our website, theworld.org. The most watched live music event on the planet is on the Eurovision Song Contest. Organizers always say that the show is not about politics. Most of the attention does go to the music, outrageous outfits, and sometimes bizarre performances. This year, though, because of the war in Ukraine, there's just no getting around the political aspect of the spectacle. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
Kalash Orchestra. It's probably the most anticipated Eurovision act this year. The band is made up of 6 musicians from Ukraine, and their song Stefania is a sort of a mashup of rap and traditional Ukrainian folk music.
Люди,
The song is classic Eurovision, and their outfits, which look like something out of a children's book, are inspired by traditional Ukrainian dress. The song was written by the band's frontman, Oleg Pasuk. Pasuk says he wrote the song before the war. He dedicated it to his mum, Stefania. But speaking to reporters at a press conference in Turin this week, Pasuk said the tune is now seen as a kind of a tribute to all mothers in Ukraine and has become something of an anthem there. Thousands of TikTok videos about the war feature the tune. Kalish Orchestra was selected to represent Ukraine on February 22nd. 2 days later, Russia invaded.
Until early this morning, some here in Kyiv doubted that he would do it. Not anymore.
On the same day, Ukrainian authorities announced that all men aged between 18 and 60 could no longer leave the country. They had to stay and defend their homeland. For a while, it looked like the band would have to broadcast their Eurovision performance from a bunker in Kyiv. But a few weeks ago, the Ukrainian government gave them permission to leave. Here's Pasuk again. Pasuk says he feels a huge responsibility representing Ukraine right now. One of the band members has stayed behind to fight. The group say they want to win the contest because of their music and not as a sympathy vote. But longtime Eurovision watcher Paul Jordan says there's no question Russia's invasion of Ukraine will influence the result.
Basically, what's going on just now has, I think, shocked the world, and I think there will be a huge public vote for Ukraine.
The song contest was originally conceived back in the 1950s as a sort of a bonding exercise between European countries after World War II. The organisers have always been at pains to keep politics out of the event. This year, though, Russia is banned from the contest, and Jordan says it's hard for the organisers now to make the claim that Eurovision is completely apolitical.
I've always argued that countries win despite the politics, so that's why you've got Russia, Azerbaijan, Israel, Serbia winning. So I think certainly it's a challenging time for Eurovision itself, because should Ukraine win, I think it'll be the first time we've actually had a country winning, possibly because of the politics.
But not all eyes are on Ukraine. There's plenty of the usual over-the-top theatrics. Meghan Markle's hair gets a shout-out in Serbia's entry. The performer goes on to sing about the importance of drinking water while washing her hands in a bowl on stage. Norway is turning heads too with this number. And before that wolf eats my grandma, give that wolf a
banana, give that wolf. It's all about feeding a wolf a banana instead of eating your grandma. You know, no one knows what the acts look like because they've got these costumes. They're dressed as wolves. One of them's dressed as a spaceman. That's the one that I think will get people talking.
The bookmakers have also tipped Sweden and the UK as possible winners this Saturday. Cultural studies professor Robert Tobin from Clark University flew to Turin this week to see the show. He tells me the fans he's met are divided on who should win.
I have to say that among the fans, I'm getting a different vibe. The fans are very excited about the UK, about Spain, about Ireland. But I do believe that Ukraine will win.
And if they do, then next year's contest should, according to Eurovision rules, be held in Ukraine. Tobin says he thinks the country will do everything to make that happen.
I would bet that they would hold it in Lviv. And, you know, I think the Ukrainians would really want to show off their resilience and their ability, you know, to bounce back and host such a major event.
But Paul Jordan is not so optimistic.
I think it's very unlikely, to be honest, even if the war stops tomorrow, it's very unlikely that Ukraine will host the event. I think, you know, there's numerous security issues there, as well as obviously in infrastructure issues too.
The Eurovision party in Turin is likely to last into next week, but the members of Kalish Orchestra will not be sticking around. Performer Oleg Pasuk says he works for a volunteer group in Ukraine that helps people find shelter, transport and medicine. Even if we win, he says, we need to go straight back home. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
Australia has scrapped all COVID testing requirements for vaccinated travellers, and it's buying airtime on American TV to make sure tourists get the message.
G'day. Next time you holiday, why go small when you can go Australia?
One thing that is not small in Australia, the Great Barrier Reef. The World Heritage Site contains 10% of the planet's coral reef ecosystems. To gauge the health of this critical piece of the environment, Australia's Great Barrier Reef Marine Authority just completed an aerial survey. The chief scientist on the job, David Wackenfeld, went online today to report the dire news.
This assessment of bleaching at multiple reefs in all four management areas confirms a mass coral bleaching event on the reef.
It is the fourth such bleaching event since 2016. Now, coral and algae have a symbiotic relationship, but with warmer water temperatures, bleaching occurs and the coral turns white and expels the algae. Both suffer. This time, bleaching happened even as Pacific Ocean temperatures cooled.
As always, I want to emphasize that bleached coral is stressed but still alive. If the water temperature decreases, bleached corals can recover from this stress.
Closer to home, a coral reef off Miami is getting worldwide attention thanks to an underwater camera streaming live video.
Here in South Florida, we're really at the forefront of climate change, sea level rise, and coral reef die-off and disease.
Marine biologist Colin Ford speaking here with the Associated Press about his project, Coral Morphologic. It combines marine life imagery with music.
We're going to actually be able to document 1 year of coral growth, which has never been done before in situ on a coral reef.
You're hearing music from Coral Morphologic's latest film, Coral City Floratour. It shows coral fluorescing under climate stress, disturbing but beautiful, and raising global awareness about the threats corals are facing. World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.